Everybody knows it's a mighty big river. Flows from Minnesota to the...
That's the voice of Jim Post. Mine is the voice of Rick Hogan. Welcome to After Hours with me. It's a jam-packed show tonight. You're going to hear from a couple of very, very fine novelists who I've never met before, but I've certainly read them. The first is on the phone with me, Bob Hartley. How are you?
Okay, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Bob, I was so taken, as many people were, with your second novel, North and Central, partly because it is so Chicago-centric, partly because it is based on the West Side, partly because it's based in a tavern, and you certainly know the tavern life. Bob, tell me a little about yourself. You were raised on the West Side, true?
That's true. I grew up in Austin in the far West Side. I lived at Chicago and Menard first until I was about 19 years old, and then we moved to North Avenue, just west of Central, when I was 19, and I lived there to about my mid-20s.
And you got a... Why did you leave Chicago? I know you got a degree in creative writing, I think creative writing, from the an MFA in fiction. That's kind of the same thing, from the University of Pittsburgh. Why did you leave, and was it hard for you to leave? Because there is... As tough as this book is, and it's been compared in many ways favorably to Nelson Algren's work, you have a great affection for Chicago, as tough as this book, North and Central, is. Why did you leave?
Well, a couple of reasons. One was that I was offered a scholarship at the University of Pittsburgh.
That's a great reason. So, yeah,
that was one reason. But also, it became more and more expensive to live in Chicago, and my wife and I were looking for... We still wanted to live in a city. We wanted to live in an affordable place, and Pittsburgh offered that opportunity, so... That's why we moved here.
When you sat down, I have not read, but I am planning to, because I was so taken with your second novel. When you wrote, it is so hard. You have entered the publishing business at a time when the publishing business is virtually insane. Was it tough to get? don't you agree?
Yes, it is. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, was it tough? I know you work in a, as we call it in the writing business, a straight job as a respiratory therapist. But was it hard to get that first book and North and Central published?
North and Central was easier because I had the first book published. Following Tommy took approximately 12 years to get it published. I finished it in 2000, and I didn't get a publisher it wasn't published till 2012.
Did you feel that getting that first book published, obviously there's a sense of empowerment in seeing your words between covers, did that change the aim and depth of North and Central in any kind of way? Did you feel more confident?
A bit, but to be honest with you, living on the West Side and experiencing the West Side gave me the motivation to write. And so whether the first book was published or not, I would have still kept writing.
Yeah.
I think people are just, driven to do it, and that certainly is the case with me.
Well, I'm going to, if you don't mind. Can I read a couple paragraphs from the book?
Oh, please do.
This is near the beginning of North and Central. North and Central takes place on the West Side, basically the Austin neighborhood, centered around a classic neighborhood tavern. And here is how Bob Hartley captures that tavern. It started getting busy around 11. First, the cops started filing through the back door. On Friday nights, there were always 3 to 4 squads parked in the alley with the windows rolled down. The cops took turns sitting out back and listening for calls. Most of the time, there were more of them in my bar than they had at roll call. Jerry, that's a big character in the book, Jerry wasn't on duty. The rest were. They threw their uniform jackets over the bar stools and their caps on the bar, then pulled out their shirt sleeves and rolled up their sleeves. I opened a dozen old styles, put them on the bar, and started their tab. They played liar's poker. Each one kept a beer in one hand and a folded dollar bill in the other. They huddled around, taking peeks and making bets. Soon there was a small mountain of crumpled bills piling up on the bar. The Zenith Factory second shift guys came next. Like the cops, they marked their territory and took up space close to the door. They threw their work coats into a booth, sat down on stools, and cranked their heads to watch the TV. Over the past couple of years, there'd been steady layoffs, so there were fewer of them, but they knew how to drink and still made up a good part of the business. They ordered pitchers and shots and threw quarters into the world, sir. They loved Iron Man and played it over and over. That is really evocative. I almost, Bob Hartley, in reading that, feel like I'm in that tavern. Did you spend it? It's almost as if I want to think that, you know, your folks ran a tavern or something. You have some real tavern experience.
Well, I don't know if that's good or not, but
I think it's good.
I was a bartender for 16 years, and also the neighborhood tavern was so much part of the culture at
sure.
the time. That and so I've been in several taverns in my lifetime, and much of it it's a composite bar, but it's based on the taverns that I had frequented. Let's put it that way.
Well, you really get it. We got to take a short little break and stay on the phone,
sure.
Bob, and we'll talk
oh, sure.
more about your fine novel, North and Central. It's also a cool cover. Are you pleased with the cover?
I'm very pleased with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'll bet. All right, I got to answer this phone. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I am on the phone with the talented novelist of North and Central, Bob Hartley, a native Chicagoan who now lives in Pittsburgh for a variety of reasons. I will also tell you to watch Mike and Joe, Micah Mater and Joe Donlan, weeknights at WGN TV News at 5, 6, 9, and 10. Bob, this novel is set in the late 70s, which was a time of incredible transition for the west side of Chicago, wasn't it?
That's correct. Yes, it was.
People losing jobs and things getting rough and tough on that west side. So tell me about the owner of the bar. He has sort of inherited it from his folks who are not well, right?
That's correct. His name's Andy. He's a 35-year-old bar owner. He has inherited it from his parents, and he's undergoing some health problems. And because the neighborhood and his business has seen economic decline, he's going to participate in crime in order to get some money together.
Yeah. There are a lot of, I mean, one of the things about this, and you have been favorably compared, you know, the funny thing is many of your jacket quotes are from friends of mine who've been on the show many times, like Joe Peterson and Bill Hillman. How do you know those guys?
Well, I actually met them through Jerry Brennan of Tortoise Books, and Jerry, just a give him a shout out, to be honest with you. Jerry is a great editor, and I sent him the manuscript. He was the one that actually accepted it and published it, and we worked on it for about 6 months, and he made it a much better book.
It's a very good book. And so he introduced him. Well, Joe Peterson, who's a great local author here, he compares you to the Studs Lonergan novels of James T. Farrell. Bill Hillman, a boxer, a running with the Bulls guy, says, "This is the Chicago story of my grandfathers and fathers and uncles. It's as tough and real and bittersweet as an old neighborhood dive. In fact, it might just be one come alive." You really do draw great characters, and I don't want to make it seem as if these are all, you know, down and outers. There are many redeemable characters. There's a love affair at the center of the book. In many redeemable characters, it's almost as if, Bob Hartley, that these people have been kind of, just like Andy, have been forced into this kind of gray area of life. Is that a decent way to put this?
Well, yeah, because if you... Part of this is that the Zenith factory of the neighborhood is going under, and it's only a matter of time. And at the time, we were told, oh, that's because the Japanese workers were better workers and because their technology, Japanese technology was better, and a host of other reasons. And it just wasn't true. And what had occurred is that there was a Japanese television cartel. The manufacturers created a cartel in which they dumped cheap televisions onto the American market while selling the same televisions at an inflated price to their own consumers.
Yeah.
So they cheated their own consumers, and then they illegally dumped cheap televisions on the American market. And they also gave illegal rebates to major retailers. So what occurred was the decimation of television manufacturing in the United States. And it wasn't only Zenith. You know,
sure.
Everybody had a Zenith or an Admiral or an RCA. So what has occurred is, yes, these people do participate in crime, but I would argue that they are also the victim of a huge crime. I can't think of another crime other than a violent crime, I guess, where you take away the livelihood of thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, you know. No, that's so well put, in you, and that shadow exists throughout your book. There's kind of a desperation to some of these lives, even the people who are not criminals, even, you know, some of the cops who are really skirting the issue. That's what makes this, Bob Hartley, your novel North and Central, so much more than a kind of, yeah, I'm sure it's nice to be called a crime novel, but it's so much more than that. You must feel that way too. I mean, it's a study in human beings at a specific time and place. Yeah,
that's exactly right. They are conditioned to think the way they do.
Yeah.
You know? So, and often you'll hear where they're speaking, they'll talk about, you know, cheap labor, and they'll blame other ethnic groups and so forth.
Sure.
And it just isn't true, but they're conditioned to think that way. And that sort of reverberates to this present time now. But also that it isn't, you know, if you go through the West Side, when I go back to Chicago, I'll take the L through the West Side.
Yeah.
And when you start to count the smokestacks and the, you know, the water towers, and then you realize those represented factories, and then you see the Brock candy, for example, which is mentioned in the book.
Yeah.
That's gone.
Yep.
You know, all of the, you know, I believe from 1970 to 1980 alone, Chicago lost over 250,000 manufacturing jobs.
Yeah, I know. And that was the main center for that. It also, the racial change in Austin was dramatic from the late 60s
right.
to the late 70s. You have done yourself proud with this. I mean, the reviews, have you been slightly at all stunned by the reviews? I mean, this guy is one guy I don't know, Noel Ignatiev. Mm-hmm. He writes, is there a Chicago school? North and Central belongs on the shelf alongside, and Bob Hartley, you've read this quote, so you've prepared for it, Sister Carrie, Studs Lonergan, Native Son, and the Man with the Golden Arm, works that truthfully portray the grit of Hartley's favorite city and of mine. As I said at the beginning of this interview, there is a palpable affection that you feel for the city, and I think there's a deep understanding of what took place in the late 70s and how it affected individual lives, lives of your own creation, these fictional lives that you place in and around this the bar, that tavern that Andy runs. Is there another novel in you, Bob?
Well, right now I'm working with Ed Blatchford of American Blues Theater.
Sure, I know Ed.
Yeah, we're going to adapt. We're attempting to adapt North and Central for the stage.
Oh, I would love to see that. I would love to see that.
And I would too.
Yeah, I'll bet.
I thought it would be a little easier than it's been, but I'm through about the fourth revision now. So, but we're getting closer, and I think it would be a good stage production. I think it'd be interesting.
So do I.
As far as reviews go, you know, what was the old adage? Don't believe your own reviews. You know,
that's a good way for an author to think. Bob Hartley, it's a terrific, terrific novel, and ladies and gentlemen out there, read it before it becomes a hit stage play in Chicago. Bob, it's great to meet you on the phone. Next time you're in town, give me a shout, will you?
I will. Thanks very much for
my
having
pleasure.
Me on. I appreciate
no, my
it.
Pleasure. I really enjoyed the book. Thank you. Thank you. Keep writing.
Thank you.
Keep writing. Keep writing.
I will try.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. It is my unbelievable pleasure to have in this studio Jennifer Engstrom. I have so many favorite actresses, and all of them seem to work for A Red Orchid. Amy Martin is at Steppenwolf, but you and Natalie West.
She's welcome to come to Red Orchid at any time.
You think she wants to join the ensemble?
Yeah. Well, just
here, Amy, there's a free
opening. Roles for her.
You too, Billy, can come over there.
Yes.
Jen is performing at Monday night at 7 o'clock at the American Writers Theater, which American Writers Museum or Hall of Fame or whatever it's called at 180 North Michigan. It's a new space on the second floor of a high rise on Michigan. It's a nice new space. Have you seen this space?
I've seen it.
You're the star attraction there.
Well, we're going to go in early tomorrow and sort of set up the space to accommodate a performance because that wasn't, you know, built in to the museum. But there is one sort of open room that will lend itself well to that, we're hoping.
You're going to do Dorothy Parker again.
Yeah, a little bit of it.
Jen, that is how we first met.
It is.
You came on one of the previous radio things
early
that I've
done.
Early in my career. Yes, the
early
morning.
And I had curlers in my hair, I remember. Yeah.
Was that part of your costume?
No. I was just literally curling my hair overnight, and you were so early that I still had curlers in my hair.
I did bits from the show. Your one-woman show is Excuse My Dust. And what occurs to me as I get older is that probably if you mention the name Dorothy Parker to people, they might say, oh, yeah, men seldom make passes at girls.
Oh, you're lucky if they know that it's seldom, because usually they say men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses.
Or,
and the word is seldom, because sometimes they do.
And the other line, you can lead a whore to culture, but you can't make her think. I suppose in many ways that works to your benefit that she has been reduced to just a couple lines, that people don't really know the depth of Dorothy Parker.
Yeah, I think that does help. I mean, at least with what I purport to do, which is to show that side. You know, we like that she's funny and will always be eternally funny, but that she was so much more than just the wisecracker and the, you know, the rhyming verse that she wrote for money, in which she came to sort of loathe that she was known for this sort of flip verse. And so she really had a roiling emotional sensibility that I don't know that she thought other people even took seriously.
Well, I think in many ways, as witty and biting as she could be, that she did. There was an insecurity there.
Yeah.
There was
a need for protection and from men in some ways. I mean, like her. I mean, she was a fierce, strong woman. I don't mean to, but
scare the listeners. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but she, her need for love. For the acceptance of the man that she loved or wanted, you know.
Well, she hung around with, I mean, she was one of the leading female members of the legendary Algonquin Roundtable.
Right.
Which was on any level, a tough crowd to be part of, and a tough crowd to become a part of. How did you discover her?
Like you do at a party, wasted, like Dorothy Parker would enjoy.
She would appreciate.
I'm sober now, so everyone can relax. But I was really, really drunk at a party, and I actually just told this story on a podcast today, but a good friend of mine, Stephen Walker, film and television actor Stephen Walker. That's kind of an inside joke. He's actually a theater actor, but Chris Jones just called him a film and television actor in his last review, which confused us all, but we're all very proud of his film and television career.
Whatever it may be.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. But we were at this party, and I apparently was, you know, saying certain
things,
and he said, you should read Dorothy Parker. And I had maybe heard of Dorothy Parker, but really didn't. Yeah. And I went out like a dutiful young, you know, gal in her 20s, so impressionable by men that I liked, and I bought the Dorothy Parker
men that you
portable.
Thought would be TV stars.
Yes, yeah. Well, I guess I knew. I guess I had an inkling. But he's actually a really brilliant theater actor and director. And so I bought the portable, the Dorothy Parker portable, and I think I just opened it up to a telephone call. And my eyes just landed on a paragraph, and it was like, when was this written? Because I swear I was going through exactly what that woman in that story was going through, which is, why won't the telephone ring? He said he would call at 5 o'clock. It's now 7:30, and then the wheels turn and turn and turn. And, you know, I mean, it sounds like, you know, slight. It sounds like, you know, why is this woman whining about a man? But we all have been in situations where we have, I think we have all, I think it's a universal condition.
No question.
Where we are, we long for the person we long for.
Yeah. She was not, she was prolific a bit. I mean, she was a prolific kind of critic and writer, but not.
She wrote a lot of book reviews and play reviews, but not a lot of stories or novels. I mean, she would. I mean, I think if she writing was notoriously difficult for her, and most good writers write slowly. She wrote said something like, "I don't write 7 words, but I change." No, I write 7 words, but change 5 or something. I'm botching up that.
Well, no, and she also, there was another line. Wow, how do I know so much about Dorothy Parker? That's so frightening. But it was something like, I hate writing, but
I loved having written.
I think it was painful for
it
her.
It was,
but she was a great critic. It's unbelievable today. I was scurrying around downstairs. And as I often do, go to the New Yorker site. And on the New Yorker site, they had an old review, as they sometimes do, of Dorothy Parker's, where she wrote. This is from 1920. Ernest Hemingway wrote a novel called The Sun Also Rises. Promptly upon its publication, Ernest Hemingway was discovered, and Stars and Stripes were reverentially raised over him. 847 book reviewers formed themselves into the word welcome.
Ah.
And the band played Hail to the Chief in 3 concurrent keys, all of which, I think, might have made Ernest Hemingway pretty reasonably sick. Now, that is in any era, in any level,
so
that is one of the great leads to a review. She's reviewing his collection, his first collection, In Our Time, which was one of the great story collections ever.
Yeah.
So you must have immediately, you must have devoured that book then.
Did, totally did. Yeah. Especially the ones that were written sort of like soliloquies.
Sure.
I think the actor in me was
Did you immediately sense this as a potential stage work for you?
I think I might have. And at the time I had no other sort of artistic calling, I guess. I mean, I was an actor. I was in my early 20s. And so I was being sent out on more commercial and television stuff and just didn't feel at home there. And, you know, I was sort of a character actress in a younger body, and it was just like sort of hitting my head against the wall. And I went home and hadn't at that point really explored, a life or career in theater.
But Dorothy Parker started to stick with you.
Oh, yeah. I think she was the first sort of, I think I might have realized a sort of calling to the stage through Dorothy Parker. I mean, I'd wanted to be an actor, but I was not necessarily sure of what kind of an actor.
Well, again, I'm not telling you what you were like in your 20s, but again, that's a kind of insecurity too, is it not, that you didn't feel prepared to take on a character and do, you know, you're not Hal Holbrook doing Mark Twain or something, you know what I mean?
No, it was doing it for the first time, and Tim Clue, if you're listening, was the reason why it ever happened in the first place.
Is that right?
That is totally right.
Tim, who, it's now at the point where everyone has been on this radio show.
I know, incestuous. No,
there's nobody in the world who hasn't been on this show.
Right.
Tim's been on this
show. Well, Tim Clue, like, really was like, Jen, I'm tired of hearing you talk about the show. We're just going to do it. And so he rented the Angel Island space, which is where Mary Archie was for years. It's now demolished.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to rent this space, and you're going to do it in 3 weeks. So get memorized. And I hated him for it. He hated him. But of course, it was the most majestic thing a friend could do. And I had a total breakdown. I mean, how do you just go from like dreaming about something to then doing it?
Yeah, how do you go from auditioning for a Midas muffler commercial to being in a one-woman Dorothy Parker
show? Well, there were baby steps. I mean, the first time I think I did half of it with like a book in my hand and it had evolved from, you know, certain stories that then were omitted and certain things have been added. There was one point where I did it at Davenport's with song.
I remember that.
You know?
I remember that. We got to take a little commercial break. I'm sitting here with Jen Engstrom, who will be She's a member of A Red Orchid Theater Company, that intensely intimate space on Wells Street.
Yes.
She will be, however, at the American Writers Museum, a relatively new space, because your boy, one of the great writers in America, Bill Zamy, has never been there. I'm going to give him a tour, personal tour tomorrow.
He's going to see it tomorrow night.
He's going to see it for the first time in a personal tour by me. But Jen's going to be performing. It's a benefit. Not a benefit. It's kind of a fundraiser for A Red Orchid. Tickets are like $100 or something. Worth it to see
booze
that space and to see Jen Engstrom do that. Just go to A Red Orchid Theater with an RE.org, and it's the second item on the homepage. You will see Jen's beautiful face there. That's how you get tickets. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm talking with Jen Engstrom, who is going to be Dorothy Parker at the benefit fundraiser for A Red Orchid. How long have you been a member of A Red Orchid?
Since 2003.
Tell people who don't know. I mean, I have written about Red Orchid often and been there often. It's I think it's the most intensely intimate theater space in Chicago.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I would. I can't think of anything. I mean, there are some smaller non-equity spaces. I think, what is it, Sideshow?
Well, anyway, if some 8-year-old is putting on a play in his basement, I'm sure it could be more intimate than that.
Right. No, you're right. It is. I mean, you are literally feet away from the front row, and it doesn't allow for any false move, really. You know, I mean, if there is, it's real detectable.
But it also, Jen, you know, it reminds me of the glory days of the legendary storefront theater movement, and it recalls for me less Steppenwolf than Remains.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a little before I got here.
Yeah, but you must.
But I know so much. I mean, like the
Billy and Amy and.
Yes, and Natalie and everyone.
Your aesthetic, you put on plays of, and I've had Shade on here and I've had Kirsten on here. Well, how do you see the sort of aesthetic philosophy of A Red Orchid?
Well, the theater doesn't shy away from uncomfortable work. You know, I think that's kind of was a hallmark for many years. I mean, it started off with Guy and Mike Shannon.
Right.
And there's these two ultra like guys, you know, macho guys. And they just, you know, they did some early Tracy Letts stuff, Killer Joe and Bug. And it was always just like a bloodbath, you know? Yeah. I mean, it was just like people, like there was stage blood everywhere and God only knows, you know, it was just like. And as we've grown up, you know, we can't always be like the theater that like eats babies on stage.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, because there literally was one called Blasted where somebody in distress.
Yeah, what's for dinner? Oh, the new baby.
You know, it was a war-torn, you know, area and he was hungry. He was starving. Anyway, now that Kirsten Fitzgerald is the artistic director, things have, you know, evolved a little bit, but we still find it incumbent upon ourselves to do work that matters, that shakes people up and maybe, you know.
And the benefit of having Michael Shannon, one of the founders of the theater, become incredibly famous is I would think it's a blessing in many ways, and I like Mike. In many ways,
Mike
kind of a curse too.
It's a curse for him, God knows, because he will pimp himself out for our theater over and over and over again. Mm. I mean, seriously. And if he's here, which he will be this summer, doing a play, he will probably be in the bathroom scrubbing the toilets too.
Yeah.
I mean, he is so dedicated to Red Orchid Theater. I know he found a home, probably for the first time, you know, as an early adult, youth.
Back to Remains, it's the same kind of thing with Bill Peterson.
Right.
It's the same kind of thing with Billy.
Right.
And it's, I think, what keeps people, no matter what kind of success they have. Otherwise, I haven't seen Malkovich on a stage here in a long time. But you know, Amy Morton's a good example.
Yeah.
And John Mahoney was a great example. Can you stay a few extra minutes?
Sure.
Can you stay? What I'm going to do? I'm in this well-oiled machine that the show. I'm going to keep Jen till like 10:20, and then we'll call this other guy and we'll figure it all out, because I want to talk more about Dorothy Parker and career, because the Dorothy Parker show, when you were last on this show some early morning a long ago in Curlers, I thought this was going to be your Harry Truman, man. Mark Twain.
But, you know, doing a solo show is very lonely, and I didn't like the loneliness of it. I mean, you know what I mean? I like.
What was it difficult to live? Because you do, in a sense, have to live with Dorothy Parker. You have to, and I would hazard to say she would be great fun to go on a date with until about 2 a.m. but then very difficult,
Tears and laments. Yeah.
Yeah. Difficult person to live with.
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure she was a difficult person for herself to live with. You know.
But what is it like for you, though?
I find comfort in it. I do. You know, I'm comforted by similarly afflicted people. I think she loved distress. She loved the drama. She was unabashedly felt sorry for herself and found perfect justification for it. And it, without whining, you know, making it funny. Like, you know, her point was like, you know, there's a story that I love called Sentiment. And it's her post breakup, and she's seeing her man in every building in New York City, and you know, her friends say, you know, she can barely function in the world, and she's, and her friends say, you know, get over it, get out, see your friends, you know, why don't sit home and moon about this man? And she says, well, what am I to do? Go out and see our friends and see the people we saw. Don't they know I can't see the friends we saw together? Yeah. I can't go back to the places where he and I have been, because he's gone. It's ended. And when it ends, and this is like the key point, when it ends, only those places where you have known sorrow are kind to you. Ooh. If you revisit the scenes of your happiness, your heart will burst of its agony.
Wow.
And that's what, you know, so yeah. I'll choose to be sad. If I'm happy, I'll remember all of our happy times, and that's too devastating.
Yeah. Now, if you've heard that and you don't want to come to this show Monday night, you're crazy. Jen is going to stick around through some commercials and the news, and I'll keep her till her chauffeur until about a quarter after and tell you a little more about, you up for that, chauffeur? Can you do that? Okay, he's ready. He's one of the great, great chauffeurs of all time. We'll be right back. Jen Engstrom I have been a fan of hers for as long as I can remember. And the first time I ever met her, she was on the morning show in Curlers, she tells me.
I can't believe you don't
talking
remember
about Dorothy Parker, which she has done in a number of places. She did it in New York.
Did it in New York at the Soho Playhouse.
And that got really good reviews.
It did, yeah. It did. It was well received. I mean, New York loves its own, you know, especially.
Oh, sure.
And so it was just real easy to pack a house full of people who wanted to hear Dorothy Parker. That was great. And I've done it in Chicago a number of times. I mean, it's never, I don't know. I love doing it. I love each piece that I've found, and each piece seems to grow as I grow.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You know,
sure.
There's not really an expiration date on any of these. They're certainly timeless. And
tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the, American Writers Theater.
Writers Museum.
Writers Museum.
There is a Writers Theater, but this is not that.
This is the American Writers Museum. It's a benefit for A Red Orchid Theater, a fundraiser kind of thing. It's a party for A Red Orchid Theater at the American Writers Museum, which I think, memory serves, 180 North Michigan. And it's a nice space. If you've never been there, you will see, I think, a lot of photos by Art Shea. And you will see a couple typewriters. I've been there a number of times.
Yeah, great. It's really cool.
It's really cool. It's a cool space.
Yeah, yeah.
You were going to be Dorothy Parker for a hour-long show, 45-minute show. What kind of show?
Tomorrow? Yes. You're referring to? Just maybe 25 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Just like a little taste. Just a little Whitman sampler platter.
And there'll be like wine and crackers.
Yeah. Oh, there's hors d'oeuvres and free booze. So just get ripped and laugh.
You don't do that anymore, though.
I don't do that anymore.
I shouldn't do that anymore.
Well,
but
you can. You've obviously can do
well,
it.
Well, I live...
I wouldn't be here talking to you today.
Well, but the great thing is a lot of people have started to live vicariously through me in that fashion.
Yes.
In that fashion. Was it your idea to do it, or were you just sitting around talking about, hey, maybe we should have some entertainment? One of your benefits, arguably the worst, was when I sat on that stage and like interviewed some actors, and I'm thinking, people would pay for this?
Yes.
What's the matter with these people?
I think they would.
Did you suggest it?
No, I didn't. It was Shade Murray. At least he was the one who reached out to me. He is one of the ensemble members and one of the artistic associates, kind of Kirsten's right-hand man, and he thought of it because it's a writer's museum, and he knew that I have this, you know, stash of Dorothy Parker in my brain almost at all times. And so it felt like the right... mix.
Do you have to prepare? Do you have to rehearse?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I've been going over stuff in my head, but that's that. I realized today I've had a lot of these sentences in my head for over 20 years, yeah. You know, and so it's just kind of unlocking them and having more freedom to play around with the words as opposed to sort
Are you sometimes? Do you sometimes? However, you're talking about. Having played this for such a length of time and sort of grown chronologically mm-hmm. into the role, do you find do you surprise yourself sometimes?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Things take on so much more meaning. Things take on so much more weight. I mean, there's a moment in this story called The Garter where her garter breaks at a party and she thinks, well, I guess for the rest of my life, I'm just going to sit here at this party and hold my garter up because it's going to fall down around my ankle. And so, you know, she starts to think in her head of like, well, everything, love and fame will pass me by. You know, that takes on more and more meaning as you get older. Love and fame will pass me by. There will be for me no riches, nor travel, nor wise new friends, nor the glittering adventure of or the sweet fruition of my gracious womanhood.
This is a stupid question, perhaps, but do you ever, Jen Engstrom, get nervous before a performance?
Never, right, honey? Yes. Are you kidding me?
Always?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just was in a show that closed about a week ago that I was constantly on the tips of my toes during that show. Not doing the show necessarily, but yeah. I do. I think it's a healthy amount, not like a debilitating amount.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A healthy amount of, you know.
And does that help enrich performance?
I would hope so. I think sometimes it does and maybe sometimes it doesn't. You know, if you're nervous enough that it doesn't allow you to kind of at some point forget yourself, then I think you can turn in maybe a sort of a overly conscious performance or something if, you know. It's waxes and wanes.
To a Red Orchid Theater with an RE.org, and you will see the means to get tickets for this show. I also think, as I'm going to do, I'm just going to show up there and say, here's like $100. Give me something to drink and let me see Jen Engstrom. I'll be like a street person coming from Millennium Park. It's a double punch. You're helping Red Orchid, and you're also getting... You will learn a little bit about Red Orchid when you're there because it's such a nice crowd of people.
Yeah.
I mean, I, to a person there, love them all.
Talented.
Love them all. What's
people.
Your next Red Orchid show?
It's a show that we'll be doing in the fall called Small Mouth Sounds by Bess Wall. And it takes place at a silent retreat directed by Shade Murray.
A silent retreat?
A silent retreat. I mean, there's some words. It's not all, it's like, we're not speaking in mime or anything.
Like it's mime.
No, there's
yes,
no
it's
please.
A mime
no,
convention.
God, no
a mime convention in the forest.
No mime at all. But because, you know, these are troubled souls, and so they have to at some point speak out, I think. But anyway, it's that's the show we're starting our season off with.
Are you? What goes on this summer at Red Orchid? You got a show?
The show at the summer is usually we rent out the space in the summer.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But this was our 25th anniversary season, and so as I've said, Mike will let us pimp his self out, and so he's doing an Ionesco play that he and Guy Van Swearingen and Amy Landecker once did, one of the first productions of a Red Orchid Theater. And so we couldn't get Amy back, but
Mike, she's a big TV star.
Huge TV star.
And Mike Shannon, by the way, premiered last night in HBO in the latest version of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah.
I'm sure
we've got a DVR and we're watching it.
He was really good in The Sound of Silence of Water.
The Shape of Water.
Shape of Water.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see what a big movie fan I am. Jen Angstrom, I cannot tell you how delightful it is to see you and your chauffeur.
Absolutely.
And I will see you Monday
night. I can't wait to see you tomorrow.
Well,
yeah.
your chauffeur and I will be in the corner plotting, doing crazy things. I can't wait to see all of you again. Just go to aredorchidtheater.org. You will scroll down on that home page. You will find all the information about the American Writers Museum fundraiser benefit party tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Love you two guys.
See you, and love you too.
Love you two guys. We'll take a break and we'll talk to Justin O'Brien about his book Chicago Yippie 1968. Welcome back to After Hours. A couple weeks ago, within the last month, I wrote a piece about Chicago in 1968, and I should have stolen all of my material from a fine, fine book by Justin O'Brien titled Chicago Yippie, meaning Yippie 1968. Justin, welcome to the show, and thank you for sending me the book. And man, you were everywhere. I thought I was everywhere in 68. You really were, weren't you?
Well, thanks for having me, Rick.
Sure.
I can't say how that happened to be, but I was down there, and I guess, knowing a lot of kids in the area, we somehow found the action.
You know, there are many fascinating things about your book, but one of the things that I was fascinated by, because it was sort of true for me, too, I was not from some kind of anti-war family. I, too, was a Boy Scout. I, too, took lessons at the Old Town School. Our backgrounds are similar in that you know, no one would pick us to be part of the wild adventures that took place during that year in that place. What drew you to it? Was it friendships with others? Or I know you were sort of caught up even young, sort of politically. But what put you at the center of all this, do you think?
Well, I like to think it was music.
Yeah, good point.
Certainly politics, we were aware of politics. We were aware of the civil rights movement that had happened, that had started before this point. And then the war, which was dragging us into it imminently, because we would be 18. I would be 18 the next year and had to register for the draft. So we were aware of this, and we kept on top of the news, and it was on the news every night.
Yeah.
But music is what really drew me down to Lincoln Park, because on weekends, all that year, and I think the previous year, there would be live music. It would be local bands and folk singers and conga drummers, and it was just a great scene.
And it was
classmates of mine and other kids that I knew from the area.
You know, one of the things, Justin O'Brien, whose book is Chicago Yippie 68, is there was even, you know, I think now sometimes people look back on 68 and it's very easy to focus, and understandably so, on the mess in Grant Park. But there was in talking about the music kind of thrown together festivals and concerts that were going on in Lincoln Park near these south end of Lincoln Park in those days, there was a real sense of innocence to it, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
You capture it really well in the book, but talk more about that.
It was a place to get together. I think these things started with a Mother's Day be-in that was held
right.
I think at Montrose, 67 or possibly earlier.
Summer of Love.
And I knew the some of the bands because back then we were fortunate enough to have teen clubs we could go to, like Young and Old Town, for example, the Electric Theater. And there was a lot of really good local talent, or at least it seemed so to us at the time. And they would play for nothing, I suppose it was for nothing,
yeah.
in the park. And,
yeah.
And that was always around, there'd be a theme. And so the Mother's Day theme, then there were the anti-war themes that followed those. And there were others as well. And it was a community that sort of grew from kids all over the city that would be attracted to this sort of a counterculture. They weren't necessarily dissatisfied kids, but I think they were seeking something new. There was something new in the air. The 60s, it seems a cliche now, but there was really something new in the air. The music was good. The vibe was good. There was a change in the air. It seems that things were going to change.
Well, one of the things that I experienced, Justin, in writing that short piece for the Tribune a few weeks ago about my experiences in 1968, modest as they were, was that line of two lines of Bob Dylan's came really true. It was, there's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear, but I get the sense for you and for me, so much of it was fun and sort of exploring a new sort of life. I really do get that sense from much of the book until we get to some of the ugliness downtown in Grant Park across from the Hilton. But that's really what it was. I mean, that exuberance, I have to believe that's one of the things that compelled you to put this down on paper, isn't it? To capture that?
Yes, it is. And I often struggle with the idea that I didn't say it well enough. It's so hard to describe what your thoughts were as a 17-year-old 50 years after the fact.
Yes.
And get to capture that innocence and that excitement and that hopefulness.
Well, I think I think in this book you absolutely do that. You also talk to and interview, you're sort of like checking your own memories with friends you've had for a long time. Was that fun for you, or was it a little make you a little anxious?
To interview other people?
Yeah.
Well, that was a suggestion of a publisher. I did run this through several publishers, and one said, well, we don't do memoirs, and for us to consider this, you should probably go out and interview other people.
Uh-huh.
And I very stubbornly didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
This is my story.
Right.
But I did do that, and I found it was a really great experience because it did help sort of, as you say, sort of confirm my own thoughts on it and my own recollections of some of the events, but it also provided counterpoint. Many of the people describe things that I think are the same events I describe, but I don't say that because it could be a different event, and there's sort of that parallax view. We saw it from a different angle, perhaps. And it turned out to be a great experience to talk to these other people.
Oh, I'll bet.
Wildly other experiences than I did. And it helped fill out the week because I couldn't be everywhere, as it must seem sometimes.
It does.
People.
No, that's one of the great things. It seemed. And our mutual friend, Abe Peck, with whom I worked for many years at the Daily News and then later at the Sun-Times, Abe, and then he went to Medill and became the world's most famous professor of journalism, writes that Justin O'Brien seemingly was ever present during 68 Chicago Convention Week. His lively recollections from the streets and the parks resurrect a polarized time of counterculture protest and potential. He really hits on something with that potential. Justin, if you can hang on for a few minutes while we get some commercials and news, I'd love to continue this conversation, okay?
Yes.
Terrific. Thank you. We'll get some commercials, then we'll get some news, and then we'll continue this conversation. Welcome back. Anyone who was alive and aware and about in 1968 will have their memories massaged and other memories evoked by reading Justin O'Brien's Chicago Yippie 68, its cover showing some guys, all guys, I think, in this one. Justin, I can't remember. Oh, there's a woman in that picture climbing one of the horses that stands in Grant Park. It is a catalog kind of one young man's journey through the time coming up to and culminating in the craziness of August 1968 when the Democrats came to town. You could not have, I could not, I was working in the basement of the Hilton for the Sun-Times and Daily News at the time, Justin, and there is no way I could have anticipated what I saw, especially on that Wednesday night when things really went nuts. Were you in any way emotionally or psychologically prepared for that evening?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, how do you prepare for that?
I know. Yeah. It was
the only preparation was there was the people who practiced in the park this Washoe Oriental method of marching, and you never saw any of that used for anything. It was no discipline at all.
No kidding. It was though for me. It was, and I think it was, and I know it was for you because I've read your book. It was terrifying to me. You too.
Oh, there's no question.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's hard to dredge that up again, but, well, I sort of do, I think.
Anytime you do?
I hear a police siren to this
well,
day.
You write in your book.
It was so random.
Well, you write in your book, in one of the two, in the epilogues, there were no tallies of how many psychological victims there were, like myself. Yeah. For many years after the convention, I remained afraid of the police. You have, since the convention, led a law-abiding life. There's no question about that, with a family and steady work for more than 40 years. I'm not going to read it, but what, because I want people to read it. But so tell them, what compelled you? Why did you need to tell this story?
This has sort of been the story of my life. This has been the tale that I've carried with me all these years. This was the big story, the big adventure that I was involved in, and it's a very powerful one to me and to anyone else who went through this. I sort of put it off to retirement. Actually, I retired and polished this up. I'd sort of worked on it all these years, sort of put down ideas and never really thought it would make a book, but
it's made quite a good book too. Has it in being able to, in thinking about it in the way you have, there's a certain sense of self psychoanalysis that goes on in doing anything like this. Has it changed you in any way? Made you feel healthier? Made you feel come to terms with anything about that era that still might have troubled you?
I can say that I'm glad I went through that experience. I think it's given me a certain sensitivity to others' similar stories and similar experiences, and a sense of frustration too that we have to keep reliving these moments right up to this day. And deja vu, boy, talk about deja vu.
Yeah, no.
The civil rights movement is still going on. Yeah. We didn't realize that was happening until the recent years. It's a shame, and it makes me angry. And I want people to know that you should be able to express yourself, and you ought to express yourself, and you should not have fear, although it can be very fearful.
Yeah. But I think this book is, in that fashion, very inspirational. Good job, Justin O'Brien. It's likely we bumped into each other sometime over that crazy, crazy summer. The book is Chicago Yippie 68. The author is Justin O'Brien. Justin, keep in touch. I hope there's another book in you. I know you're a very prolific freelance writer, but keep me posted on your next books.
Thank you very much. I will.
My pleasure. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.
Having.
Now we're going to take a little commercial, and then we're going to talk to a man who is coming out with what might be 2019's bestseller. your own. That's him. You can tell his laugh. Well, the book was kind of born on this show, and we'll see how Roger Badish is coming. It's been long overdue, but I didn't want to distract you. He was on here, and we started kind of an oral history of your life.
Exactly.
And then you started writing it, so I didn't want to get in the way. We are going to check in and see how the book is coming right after this commercial break. Now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce 2019's best-selling author, your own. You know him, you love him. He does the news here, but he and I have had an ongoing conversation about his life, which I have found fascinating, all of the things he's done. Roger Badish, how's the book coming?
I've got two chapters done.
Come on. You have to have more done than two.
Nope. I did the chapter on my 3.5 years in Las Vegas, but mm-hmm. I've done a first draft. Have not gone back to edit it.
Okay. That's probably smart, though.
Well, you can only remember so much as you go through it, and I got to a point where I'm starting to research some of my memory.
Oh, my God.
Like, well, there's stuff I kind of remember, but I'm forgetting some details, and I want to make sure that my memory is accurate. Mm-hmm. At this stage of the game. So I started to go back, but then I was like not getting the chapter written because then I got lost in the loop of research old time.
Sure.
So I figured, you know what? I'll come back and revisit this. At least let me get the chapter done. So I did that. And then I figure, well, while I remember, since it's fairly recent, as opposed to the old stuff I would have to research, I decided to do my 20 years of teaching.
Interesting.
And the format of the book, as you and I have discussed off air, is kind of unique. I have already written maybe 30% of the book.
Yeah.
Different chapters, depending on what it is. I've already written. It's out there. I need to incorporate that into my other memories in the book. So as I'm doing the teaching chapter, the earlier years of my teaching years, that was not chronicled in this other format.
Right,
I'm going off memory. And then I thought, and I wrote maybe a week ago, because I've only been able to sit down and write like one day a week, which is not
enough.
No. And I could do it for maybe 3-4 hours. I'm going to do more over the summer. I'll have more time because, you know, 3 days a week I'm focused on working here.
Sure.
3 days a week I'm focused on the grandkids.
Sure.
And then one day a week I'm doing chores. So, you know.
Well, but wait a minute. Tolstoy had like 9 children, so don't, you know.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, I've got no excuse then.
Yeah.
And his books were a lot
big.
Longer.
Were huge.
Huge. They were grandiose. So it took me a while, and about a week or so ago, I wrote online that, my God, I don't think this chapter will ever end.
Yeah, I know.
Because I had finally gotten up to the 2 years that I was at Clemente High School, and which, of course, would lead into the next chapter, which is the cancer.
Yeah.
Because it would flow.
Sure.
And so I thought it would never end. And then suddenly I sat down, Wednesday or Thursday. It was Thursday. And doing this format that I'm doing, all of a sudden, it just started. I had it all.
Wow.
And all I had to do was copy and paste and copy and paste and copy and paste and format. And so I've finished the first draft of the chapter on 20 years of teaching.
That's
and it's
great.
194 pages.
That's good. So what?
Typewritten
Tolstoy.
With the march. I have no Tolstoy.
Leo Tolstoy Jr.
Oh my gosh.
Well, are you finding the experience? I know you're finding it all new because you have never embarked on a book project like this. Are you finding it? You seem to. I'm just looking at your face. You see, it's got to be on some level enjoyable for you.
It's
frustrating and enjoyable at the same time.
It's cathartic.
Yeah.
It's I'm revisiting stuff that I never gave a second thought to.
Interesting.
Because I'm the kind of person that once I've done something,
sure.
You've even told me that who I am. You're very insightful, and I'm not one to dwell on stuff I've done already. I've been told I'm very unassuming, and I you know, whatever's done is done.
Yeah,
that's why.
One of the things that would inform that is beating cancer too. You know, that it would be like you become forward looking.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know,
you don't start dwelling on the past when
right.
something like that happens to you, something cathartic like that.
Right.
It's all forward momentum.
Sure.
Which makes one kind of reluctant to look back, I guess.
Well, it's not that I don't want to look back. It's that, oh, yeah, I remember doing that kind of, but if I'm going to detail it in a book for people who don't know me.
Right, right.
Or might want to know me, whoever.
Yeah.
Then I have to get more detail than I actually allow myself to remember.
What are you doing with have you even disembarked, even beside the other mm-hmm. form you're taking on mm-hmm. the political years?
I will. That will be a chapter.
I think that's going to flow. I think that, for some reason, I think that's going to come easily to you.
It will come easily to me because, again, I've documented some of that, which will trigger
sure,
memories.
More of it. Just
again,
installing
like,
this stuff in Harold Washington's house, man. That's another part.
I'll
tell you, ladies
yeah.
and gentlemen, over if you've been listening, I know there are a lot of regular listeners out here. When Roger was in here before this became a book project, when he was kind of doing an audio version
right.
of the book before,
and I still have to go back and listen
before,
to those. What
before,
did I say?
That's right. You can have those. Those are transcripts. They're 40 pages right there, telling these fascinating stories. When I, said, "Hey, man, maybe this should be a book," and you do, without mentioning names, you do. There's a publisher interested in this
yeah.
already, right?
Yeah,
and
very.
And when you pitched it to this publishing house, how did you pitch it? Just as my life story?
I didn't have to pitch it.
Wow.
The publisher has known of me and has even written about me.
Interesting.
So, and they came to me.
That's great.
And again, I'm going, are you sure you got the right? I know there's only one Roger Badish in the phone
book. That comes
to
self-effacing Roger Badish. I know.
But that's the way I am.
I know, that's you. I know,
I
know.
That's why I got to go back and research all this stuff, because as I went through it, it was a job. It's what I did.
Yeah.
And it's like I didn't chronicle every day what I was doing.
Of course not.
Because at that time, it was, you know, I knew when I went to work for Jane Byrne that it was a big deal because she was the first female mayor of the city of Chicago.
Indeed.
I knew that it was a big deal when I was the only one in the press office kept by Harold Washington.
Because he was the first black mayor of the city
exactly.
of Chicago.
And it was just, you know, I knew at the time that I was lucky.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, if they don't keep me, I got to look for another job.
Right, right,
you know?
Right.
But I'm like, okay, and I'm going to keep doing what they've asked me to do. And apparently, I'm still working there, so they
well.
Like what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I know there's tons of people who are out there. They go to work every day. They do their job. They go home, and they don't think it's a big deal of what they do. And there are way too many who what they do is a big deal.
Yeah.
To more than just them.
No question.
And they'll never understand the impact that it has on others. And you say that I'm self-effacing and unassuming, and yet I have heard from people, especially from the cancer thing,
yeah.
of the effect that what I've written on Facebook and Twitter, that what I've written and how I approach that saved them. I'm blown away by that. I still can't comprehend that as a human
wow.
being for I don't know what reason.
Yeah.
Because
but you know what it is? It's humbling.
It's
humbling that what you have to say might help another person. It's humbling.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's, we're working on, like I say, the next chapter will be the cancer chapter, because I've already approached
sure.
that in the teaching chapter.
Have you set yourself, mm-hmm. the most important thing in writing, have you set yourself a deadline for this book?
No, that's even beyond, there's no deadline yet.
You're like every writer I know, Roger Badish. What's the matter with you? You're like every writer in the world.
Let's put it, here's the deadline. I'll get it done.
Okay.
I'll get it done. I've got the summer when the grandkids are out of school, and I'll have more time other than my honey-do list. To get some writing done. It'll also afford
me. What does
she
think of this?
She wants to know about when I write about her
uh-huh.
and how she's going to be in the book. And I said, don't worry about it.
Don't worry.
And that's another thing that I'm running into. It's like some of the stuff
personal.
That I want to, you know, how far do I go? Not just about, you know, our marriage and our time together.
Sure.
But there's other stuff, and I've already come into that at one point in my teaching, actually a couple of points in the teaching career. It's like, you know what? You don't need to say that.
Yeah. That's good.
It only means
self-editing. You're self-editing.
Yeah.
Which is really smart. Which is really smart. Roger Bettish, anytime you want to come on and talk some of this out, I'd love to. I have tried to stay away from it ever since we launched it.
Right.
Because I just want... I want the book. I want the book. I want to sit here and talk to you about the book. Roger, I can't wait. And it's a pleasure for me to work with you.
Thank you. I appreciate all your help and encouragement.
You have a title for it yet?
I do. I'd rather not say it because it's a working title.
Okay.
But it alludes to the style, the format of a lot of the book.
Its title is War and Peace, : The Roger Bettish Story. We got to take a break, get some news, and sign off. So we'll do that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another edition of After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. Ben produced much of the show. Aubrey engineered all of it. I hosted much of the show, too. We will see you next weekend.